Since taking this office, I've never been more optimistic about a year ahead than I am right now.
Well, that's optimistic, Mr. President. I'll take it, I guess.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Up in Oregon, KYAQ on the Central Coast, KSO in Cozy Cottage Grove. Out in Pennsylvania, 93 FM WLRI in Lancaster. Out in Ohio, Hawaii, KAKU, the voice of Maui. Coast to coast and around the globe on kpfk.org. Streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, Radio or Not, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR in Nashville, and of course, Radio Sputnik 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com with another thrilling action-packed adventure that we call the Bradcast. Glad you could join us this morning, this afternoon, this evening, whenever you may be lucky enough to tune in. Desi Doyen, of course, joins me as ever, our producer here. Hey, Desi Doyen, how
are
you?
Hey, I am here. I am good.
I know the only thing you're doing is waiting for Star Wars. I understand. I understand. Everybody is just waiting for Star Wars. Me too, by the way. And the president. The president is apparently watching Star Wars in the White House, or at least they're screening it in the White House today for a bunch of school children.
And Gold Star families.
And Gold Star families. Lucky them. The president is also flying out west on his way towards his holiday out in Hawaii. He'll be stopping in San Bernardino on the way out to speak with families of victims of the San Bernardino shootings out here. But before he left, a lot of news going on in Washington, D.C., and a lot of news going on not just at the White House and in Congress before they all break for the holiday, but also, I was going to call it a squabble, but more than a squabble between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And really, more specifically, I suppose, Bernie Sanders and the DNC, who the Sanders campaign is now suing. So that is just happening as we go to air. We'll try to get to all of that and much more ahead on today's Bradcast. So let's jump right into the agreement struck in Congress. And this is, kind of a welcome relief for those in the news industry who have spent the last few years, even literally on New Year's Eve, waiting for Congress to come up with an agreement to keep the government from shutting down before the midnight hour on New Year's Eve to agree on a spending package. Well, now Congress has, in fact, come to such an agreement, surprising a lot of people by overwhelmingly approving a massive omnibus bill, 2016 tax and spending package, sending it to the president for his signature. And here we are, not even a week before Christmas. What the... he spoke at a press conference today, the president did, about this bill. We'll get to that momentarily. But he said there's some things in there that I don't like, but that's the nature of legislation and compromise. And he said, I think the system worked. The legislation puts two enormous bills, a $1.14 trillion government-wide spending measure to fund every cabinet agency through next September. So I guess we can look forward to the next fight in next September, just before the election. And also a bill, a $680 billion tax package that extends dozens of tax breaks, making some of them permanent and tossing the entire cost into the deficit. So Republicans got some of the tax breaks that they wanted, and without paying for them, they go into the deficit. We are going to pay for them, I suppose, down the road. Republicans and Democrats joined to approve this spending bill on a resounding 316 to 113 vote in the U.S. House. So, and actually, majorities from both parties voted in favor of this thing. The Senate voted 65 to 33 to send the entire package to Obama's desk. Of course, hardliners and the Republican side mostly were disappointed because they didn't get a lot of the riders that they had wanted in there. Planned Parenthood, cutting off funding for Planned Parenthood, stopping Syrian refugees from settling in the U.S. Some of the GOP presidential candidates in the Senate opposed the legislation. Of course, Senator Marco Rubio of Florida did not even bother to show up and vote, as is his wont. He pretty much never shows up to vote anymore. Ted Cruz and Rand Paul of Kentucky both voted no on the bill. Yet few conservatives were complaining, according to Associated Press, about Speaker Paul Ryan himself. Many lawmakers, Republicans and Democrats alike, proudly touted their accomplishments here and those that they have achieved since the new Speaker of the House was sworn in just a few weeks ago at this point. So they've passed at year end here bipartisan bills on highways and education and a 2-year budget and a debt deal that now paves the way for the spending and tax legislation that was finalized on Friday and sent to the president. Democratic leaders Nancy Pelosi of California and in the House Harry Reid of Nevada complained about a provision lifting the 4-decade-old ban on exporting crude oil, which we talked about in our Green News report this week,
right,
as it happened. But in exchange, both Pelosi and Reid boasted of concessions that they received from Republicans, including a five-year extension of solar and wind tax credits.
Yeah, that's a really big deal.
Well, this was a big deal, a big goal for Harry Reid. Have they ever had a 5-year, or it's usually 2 years?
It's usually very short term. It's generally has to be re-voted on and reauthorized every congressional session. And what it does is it creates a great deal of uncertainty for the renewable energy industry because investors want to know, oh, wait, are you going to take this thing away from me that you just gave us? And to companies to have, some kind of certainty up ahead for the funding landscape that they are going to be approaching when they have these gigantic projects with huge capital intensive requirements to start. So that was one big thing that came in with that.
Democrats also blocked some of those policy riders that I had mentioned, the Planned Parenthood and so forth, but also they blocked riders that Republicans were looking for on the environment and other issues. They were trying to curb the EPA's authority. Nancy Pelosi gloated, according to AP, saying that the Republicans wanted big oil so much that export, the lifting of that export ban. They wanted big oil so much that they gave away the store, says Nancy Pelosi.
Well, that's probably overstating it quite a bit.
I think she is.
I think so.
But you know what? There's thousands of pages in this bill. Maybe there's some stuff she knows about that we have yet to figure out.
Yeah. And there's one thing in there that just really quick that is really important is, yes, the extension of the renewable energy tax credits. It's not just important, but what it does is the extension for 5 years on some of those credits and 7 years from some of those other credits is that it will help to get the renewable energy industry over the hump until the clean power plan, Obama's clean power plan, actually comes into effect. So being able to have that kind of financial regulatory approach and support before that comes into effect, that really does sort of help bridge that gap that was concerning for many people watching the renewable energy industry.
For his part, President Barack Obama held his year-end press conference touting a number of accomplishments as he saw it over the year, touting the drop in unemployment rate and the uninsured healthcare uninsured rate that just dropped to just 10%, and also the lowest growth rate for healthcare costs in decades, obviously citing the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare plan that seems to be working. Of course, there are still 10% of Americans who don't have any coverage. A lot of that is due to the fact that Republican states will not expand Medicaid as allowed for in this bill, which would give millions more Americans the coverage that they need to stay healthy. But still, we're now down to 10%, which is a huge drop in the uninsured rate in this country. The president also went on to tout this year's clean energy industry boom and the Paris Agreement, the Paris Accord, to cut greenhouse gas emissions that caused global warming. He said that was, quote, only possible due to American leadership. He also celebrated the conclusion of the landmark trade deal, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which, while he has concluded that agreement, it still needs to be voted on in Congress. And I think we're going to be talking about that next week a little bit, because that has sort of one of many things that have gotten lost over recent weeks with all of the talk of the terror attacks, both in Paris and in San Bernardino, and the presidential race and the Republicans freaking out. That TPP is still on the table, and it is still opposed by both Republicans and Democrats alike, and also supported by both Republicans and Democrats alike. So a fight lays ahead on that. After decades of advocacy, the president said marriage equality became a reality in all 50 states this year. That's true and a good thing. He thanked Congress for an education bill, transportation bill, allowing states to put people back to work, building roads and bridges. That will be nice. He says, of course, there is still work to do. Congress needs to promote job growth, increase wages, reform the criminal justice system. The president cited the fact that he had commuted sentences today of 95 Americans. Well, that's good, but he has still given fewer pardons and commutations than any other president in recent history. He says that the U.S. continues to lead the global coalition to destroy ISIL or ISIS or the Islamic State or Daesh, whatever you want to call it. He says that ISIS has lost 40% of territory that it controls in Iraq and has made significant gains. The U.S. has made significant gains and their coalition partners significant gains against ISIL in Syria. And he called for Americans to, quote, refuse to be terrorized. Well, good luck with that, Mr. President. He did go on to say, as we played in our opening quote, that since taking this office, I've never been more optimistic about the year ahead than I am right now. So that was an optimistic President Barack Obama at his year-end press conference. And I'm going to play one of the points that he made, an answer to a question from a reporter. But before I do, I need to sort of set up what happened, because there is a lot of confusion. And there was a number of questions about this, about whether the government needs to do more in its so-called fight on terror by reviewing the social media of all of the people who are applying for visas coming to the U.S. This on the heels of the San Bernardino attack and the claims that one of the attackers, Tashfeen Malik, had made proclamations on social media that the government completely missed because, oh, they're just not fighting terror hard enough, apparently. And this comes in the wake of a New York Times article on Sunday, which reported that the U.S. government had missed something that was key, that was sitting right out there in the open, that the jihadist social media posts by one of those San Bernardino killers was sitting right there and the government just wasn't working hard enough, didn't find it. Tashfeen Malik, the paper reported on Sunday in the lead of their article on this. Malik, who with her husband carried out the massacre in San Bernardino, California, passed three background checks by American immigration officials as she moved to the U.S. from Pakistan. None covered what Ms. Malik had made little effort to hide, that she talked openly on social media about her views on violent jihad. She said she supported it and that she said she wanted to be a part of it. That was reported by the New York Times. And as the New York Times public editor now says, that was certainly damning and it was wrong. Ms. Malik had not posted openly on social media. She had written emails. She had written private messages on a social media app, but she did not make any of that visible to the public. And this is no small thing. As Eric Wemple has been reporting over the week at Washington Post, there is a huge difference between how you report this, a huge difference between simply posting a private message, an email, versus posting something publicly on your timeline. Josh Marshall says one set of facts is roughly the equivalent to finding out after the fact that Malik had discussed jihad with friends privately via email. The other makes the mistake that the entire government counterterrorism operation seems incompetent. Even unintentionally, it amounts to mainstream media disinformation. And Margaret Sullivan, the public editor over at the New York Times, agrees and absolutely excoriated her own paper. As well she should. Because as that story got picked up throughout the week, it was used to, as an attack on the government, an attack on Democrats, an attack on President Obama. She notes that it was not long before Republican presidential candidate Ted Cruz was using it to bash Democrats. Well, the reporters got it completely wrong. Mother Jones is now calling for those reporters to be dismissed entirely. Salon.com called it an epic reporting fail with dire national consequences. The public editor, again, Margaret Sullivan, said she talked with the executive editor of the New York Times, Dean Baquette. He said that they are now putting some new procedures in place, that they need to put them in place, especially for dealing with anonymous sources, because once again, they were dealing with anonymous sources. So were anonymous sources simply feeding this misinformation to the New York Times in order to make Democrats look bad? Does that sound familiar? Did that march us towards war 10 years ago, 15 years ago, wherever we are at this point? So we're seeing the same thing that we had seen a decade ago, still at the same paper of record, the New York Times. Now, the executive editor has admitted this was a really big mistake. And more than anything else, since I've become editor, it does make me think we need to do something about how we handle anonymous sources. Oh, you think? He said that this was a system failure that we have to fix. Public editor called on them to slow down at the New York Times. She said the Times needs to fix its overuse of unnamed government sources. It needs to slow down the reporting and editing process, especially in the fever pitch atmosphere surrounding a major news event. Those are procedural changes, and they are needed, she said. But most of all, and more fundamental, the paper needs to show far more skepticism, a kind of prosecutorial scrutiny at every level of the process. Two front-page, anonymously sourced stories in a few months have required editors' notes that corrected key elements, she writes, elements that were integral enough to form the basis of the headlines in both cases. That is not acceptable for Times readers or for the paper's credibility, which is its most precious asset. At this point, I'm led to say to the New York Times, what credibility? Public editor goes on to say, if this isn't a red alert, I don't know what will be. Yes, this stuff matters. And in fact, as I said, President Obama was asked about it today at the press conference by a reporter who said, well, you know what? Some people, I guess, including the New York Times here, that the government should review the social media of all people applying for visas coming to the U.S., and the president had to try as best he could in any event to clear this up, citing some of this quote-unquote garbled reporting.
The issue of reviewing social media for those who are obtaining visas, I think, may have gotten garbled a little bit because there may be it's important to distinguish between posts that are public, social media on a Facebook page, versus private communications through various social media or apps. And our law enforcement and intelligence professionals are constantly monitoring public posts And that is part of the visa review process that people are investigating what individuals have said publicly and questioned about any statements that they may be made. But if you have a private communications between two individuals, that's harder to discern by definition. And one of the things we'll be doing is engaging with the high-tech community to find out how we can, in an appropriate way, do a better job if we have a lead to be able to track a suspected terrorist. But we're going to have to recognize that no government is going to have the capacity to read every single person's text or emails or social media. If it's not posted publicly, then there are going to be feasibility issues that are probably insurmountable at some level, and it raises questions about our values. I mean, keep in mind it was only a couple of years ago where we were having a major debate about whether the government was becoming too much like Big Brother. And overall, I think we've struck the right balance in protecting civil liberties and making sure that U.S. citizens' privacy is preserved, that we are making sure that there's oversight to what our intelligence agencies do. We're going to have to continue to balance our needs for security with people's legitimate concerns about privacy.
So balancing those needs, we now have people calling once again for looking at absolutely every single person's email, which is what you would have to have done to have discovered this conversation about jihad by the San Bernardino shooters. You'd have to look at every single piece of email put out by every single person, not just in this country, but in the globe. Is that what you want? Well, apparently some people do want that. And not only do they want that, they want the government, the U.S. government, to have a key to unlock absolutely every piece of encrypted data that people may now use in some of these applications that actually encode the data that you send back and forth. This is absolutely key for what we do for our online banking and everything else encryption is. And the companies that make these systems, including companies like Apple, and Google, they don't want to give that key away to the government because, well, for a number of reasons. One, they don't think the government ought to be able to look into every single communication that occurs. But also they're concerned that if you create a back door for the world, for the government, that the world will come in and take it. That's something that, will come in and take that key. That's something that apparently is not understood by Republican presidential candidate John Kasich, governor of Ohio, who seemed to be at the Republican debate recently in Vegas, far less concerned about guns, which actually kill people, and seemed to suggest that it was encryption, data encryption, that is actually so dangerous to Americans. Here's John Kasich.
There is a big problem. It's called encryption. And the people in San Bernardino were communicating with people who the FBI had been watching, but because their phone was encrypted, because the intelligence officials could not see who they were talking to, it was lost. We have to solve the encryption problem. It is not easy. We need to be able to penetrate these people when they are involved in these plots and these plans, and we have to give the local authorities the ability to penetrate the disrupt. That's what we need to do. Encryption is a major problem, and Congress has got to deal with this, and so does the president, to keep us safe.
Thank you, Governor.
Now, in fact, most of that is untrue. They could have tapped into the communications between the San Bernardino shooters, but there was no reason to do so because they had no idea that they were plotting jihad because it had never been discussed publicly, at least as far as we know, by either of these people. Now, the White House so far, to their credit, is resisting calls to revisit a decision made earlier this year when they sided with privacy advocates and cybersecurity experts warning against forcing technology companies to weaken the electronic safeguards that they offer on products like the iPhone and social media sites like Facebook. The Obama administration, as reported by Politico, seems to be showing every sign of sticking with that stance. They are not, at least as of now, going to change their position on encryption. So this would, well, according to privacy experts, as Politico notes, that would be a very dangerous thing to do. I spoke recently with Trevor Tim of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, who talked exactly about some of those dangers of allowing a secret, well, not even a secret, allowing a back door for the government to get into encrypted communications.
You can use encryption as long as you give us the key. That's the law that they would like to pass. Unfortunately, security doesn't work that way. I mean, you know, put aside the fact that, if this was ever a power given to government, they would inevitably abuse it, because as we've seen over and over again in history, they constantly abuse their surveillance powers. But even let's just say that we trust the government 100% and that they will never abuse the power of having a key, and that they will only use it when they have a warrant for information. The problem with that is that that key is still vulnerable to all of these other actors who will try to steal it. They will try to steal that key from the U.S. government, which, as we've seen, is not that hard to do, given that the entire U.S. government, it seems, has been hacked over the past couple of years by various forms of government. Whether we're talking about State Department emails that were hacked by allegedly the Russian government, whether it was all of the 20 million people who had applied for security clearances, whether it's the White House email system, all these things we've found out over the past year have been hacked and infiltrated by all of these third parties. And we're going to say, oh, yeah, we trust you with the one key that will unlock every single person's communications. That, to me, sounds like a crazy idea.
It is a crazy idea. What could possibly go wrong? Trying to make sense of the difficult to understand, and it certainly doesn't help when the paper of record, New York Times, helps confuse everything by blatantly misreporting, apparently, whatever they hear from anonymous sources. We have enough trouble making sense of it all here in this country, as I'll make clear, and as we have more data breaches to discuss straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Stay tuned. Broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com with you here. Just a few more points here on this issue of encryption, which is coming up more and more. I think you're going to hear it louder and louder, and it is difficult to make sense of. But I think that Apple CEO Tim Cook, who made this comment back in June, as noted by Politico, puts it very well. Politico reports, Silicon Valley's best and brightest insist there is no technological fix for encryption that wouldn't leave consumers vulnerable, and that any attempt to design in a back door for police and intelligence agencies would inevitably be used by hackers and criminals. Tim Cook said, if you put a key under the mat for the cops, a burglar can find it too. Yeah, good point. Not to mention, if we require U.S. Companies like Apple to put a key under the mat, to give a key to the U.S. government to decrypt all communications from all cell phones and so forth, other people, you know, people in other, we can't make other countries do it as well. So some of the biggest corporate stars of the U.S. tech industry, such as Apple, Google, Cisco, they also fear that overseas customers will simply go use other products rather than U.S. made products if we include weak encryption mandates by the U.S. government in the products that we make here. Politico reports that even if police and intelligence agencies secured a way into American encryption systems, terrorists could still shield their communications using applications from companies that are beyond the reach of U.S. law. A security guide that ISIS uses to educate recruits advises using applications such as an app called Telegram, made in Berlin, Germany. And their website boasts that the messages, this Telegram application, their messages are heavily encrypted and can self-destruct. So they're concerned that people will go use other products instead of products from U.S. companies. So it will make U.S. consumers themselves less safe, vulnerable to hacking, will, you know, send business away to foreign companies. Tech lobbyists said that the FBI failed to make a compelling case for its backdoor proposals when they met recently. The Bureau could not point to a specific example where a backdoor was the only way to get information, especially given the richness of digital information sources in an always connected world. Remember, when people use simple text messages, those are not encrypted. We can already spy on those. We can already scoop all of those up. So, you know, most people don't use encryption for a lot of their communications. And meanwhile, the FBI has not been able to come up with an example of, oh, if we had only had a back door, if we had only had the key to encryption here, we could have stopped this attack or that attack. So that debate's going to continue. Meanwhile, a data breach within the Democratic Party is roiling many this weekend. Man, this is a big story now. A big fight between Bernie Sanders, or at least the Sanders campaign, and the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, which the Sanders campaign has now filed a lawsuit against within the past hour since just before going to air here. Okay, so here's what happens. Here's what happened that caused this fight. Apparently, the DNC has a great big database with voter information. It rents it to all of the campaigns, all the Democratic campaigns who would like to use this information. And then the campaign is allowed to update, each campaign is allowed to update their own database with their own information about voters. And then that's all kept in sort of one great big huge database, but there is a firewall between the various campaigns. So each campaign gets to use the DNC data and then add to it with their own data. That data is then used to target likely voters in, for example, the early voting states coming up right now in this very contentious race at this point between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton in Iowa and in New Hampshire, et cetera. That's important information that they are using every day, not just to target voters to get out the vote, but also to raise money. So firewalls are put in place to prevent campaigns from looking at the data that their rivals have collected and that have added to and so forth. But officials said that the vendor who runs the DNC's database, a company by the name of NGP Van, ran a software patch on Wednesday that allowed all the users on the system to access each other's data, to access the data belonging to other campaigns. So they're considering it a data breach, even though there was no hacking here. It didn't enable any private information to go public, but it did allow information to go. It did allow Hillary Clinton's information to be seen by the Sanders campaign. And now Bernie Sanders' campaign is angrily accusing the DNC of, quote, taking our campaign hostage on Friday after the DNC barred the Sanders campaign from accessing a trove of information about potential voters. This as punishment for improperly accessing data compiled by the campaign of rival Hillary Clinton. The reaction of the DNC to the data breach, the depths of which was debated by everybody, is still being debated about how bad this actually was. Thrust into the limelight, this long-standing suspicion among Sanders and his supporters that the DNC is unfairly working to support the candidacy of the front runner. Something we've talked about on this show, the fact that the way that the DNC has scheduled debates. There is another debate on Saturday, the Saturday before Christmas, rather than out in the open the way the Republicans are doing it, in primetime, weekday primetime. It seems like they're hiding their debates for some reason. The theory of Sanders supporters is that the DNC is purposely doing this to help Hillary Clinton because more debates seen by more people will somehow hurt Hillary Clinton. Now, the fact of the matter is that has been exactly the opposite of the truth. Since there has been Democratic debates, Hillary Clinton has had a bump in the polls after those debates. When there's not holding debates, Bernie Sanders seems to climb in the polls. So it seems to be the absolute opposite of what the DNC might have wanted, or at least what the Bernie Sanders campaign is accusing the DNC of wanting, of supporting Hillary Clinton. Nonetheless, that has been the call. There's been a lot of acrimony in that regard between Sanders and the DNC. The Sanders campaign manager, Jeff Weaver, came out on Friday and said, clearly in this case, they are trying to help the Clinton campaign by blocking Sanders' access to this database at this point. DNC chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz responded that the Sanders campaign had inappropriately and systematically accessed Clinton campaign data. Rejecting Weaver, the campaign chair for Bernie Sanders, rejecting his portrayal of the event as the fault of simply a software glitch and then a small rogue group of staffers. Clinton campaign spokesman Brian Fallon said the campaign was informed that our proprietary data was breached by Sanders' campaign staff in 25 searches by 4 different accounts, and that this data was saved into the Sanders campaign account. Now, it's unclear at this point just how bad this data breach was, how much information was actually accessed, how inappropriate it was. The Sanders campaign, for their part, has fired the data director, a guy by the name of Josh Uretsky. He has now been fired for accessing the Clinton campaign's information. Uretsky said that his team was merely investigating the security problem and trying to figure out how exposed their own data was following the software patch on Wednesday. He said, I believe that I took appropriate steps to audit and assess the security breach and that nothing I did was done in a way that it would give the Sanders campaign a competitive advantage. Nonetheless, Josh Uretsky was fired by the Sanders campaign for whatever it was that he did. And then thereafter, the DNC completely cut off Bernie Sanders from the data, which includes his own data, the campaign's own data. Campaign manager for Sanders said, this is information that we have worked hard to obtain. It is our information, not the DNC's. And so they have now filed suit at this point against the DNC, the Bernie Sanders campaign has, claiming that they had no right to cut them off from this information, that the agreement that they had with the DNC required that if there was a data breach of this sort, or at least of the sort that the DNC is now alleging the Sanders campaign carried out, that the Sanders campaign should have 10 days notice to respond to that this, even if this was a breach of contract, that the non-breaching party should be sent a notice and given 10 days to respond. The Sanders campaign, in their lawsuit, they say they raise about $600,000 to $800,000 per day through the use of that list that they can no longer access. So that every day that that they don't have access at this point is costing them, anywhere from $600,000 to $800,000. They are seeking injunctive relief. this is the battle that is ongoing. Bernie Sanders supporters are furious about it. Hundreds of thousands have now signed a petition over at moveon.org. So while the Democratic race has been largely peaceful, at least up until now, between the candidates who have been, you know, out there making the case for themselves rather than attacking each other, as we're saying on the Republican side, things are turning substantively darker, perhaps, with this alleged data breach. And now this lawsuit filed by one of the leading candidates for president of the United States against the Democratic Party. Wow. We'll see. I was going to say much more on this story to come, but we'll see. Perhaps Democrats will simply cave. They don't want this problem. Or perhaps no one will notice because, you know what? They'll work it all out over the weekend before Christmas when no one's paying attention. Man. More Bradcast ahead. I'm Brad Friedman. Stay tuned.
Okay, everybody, I got to get to Star Wars.
The president doesn't get to Star Wars. Star Wars comes to the president. Man, the Star Wars playing for school children and Gold Star families at the White House today before the president left for his Christmas vacation. Frankly, who am I kidding? I was going to tease that. I was going to play the theme song and say my interview with Harrison Ford coming up in moments, but... Don't laugh. But who am I kidding? Everyone is out. Yeah, nobody's listening. They're all watching Star Wars. That's all that's happening.
It's probably spoilerific out there, so don't turn on any social media if you don't want any spoilers. No spoilers, please.
Not only did the Democratic Party schedule their the debate, this is their last debate before I believe people will actually cast votes in the Iowa caucuses. In the 2016 election, this is their last debate. I think I'm correct about this. So the last debate, the final debate before people actually start voting, is taking place on a Saturday, and a Saturday before Christmas, and the Saturday that Star Wars: The Force Awakens opens.
Okay, actually, it looks like there is a Democratic debate on January 17, and I believe, if I've got my dates right, that the Iowa caucuses are February 1st.
Okay, so there will be one more debate?
It's what it looks like.
And what day, is that? Saturday? Another Saturday?
The day of the week, January 17? I have no idea. Well, I'll have to go look that up, too.
In any event, they don't seem to be going out of their way to put
It's a Sunday.
It's a Sunday. There you go. They don't seem to be going out of their way to let voters find out what it is they believe and what they stand for, which is kind of crazy. I'm not sure why they would be embarrassed about any of it. I don't think they are embarrassed about it at all, which does add fuel to the charge that the Sanders proponents charge that, in fact, they think this will somehow help Hillary.
But, you know, when you bring up that statistic that when they do hold debates, Hillary's popularity goes up.
She does great.
And when they don't hold debates, Bernie's popularity goes up. So it seems like maybe that was their calculation in the past. They won't say so, but gosh, now would be a good time to maybe recalculate.
They could change it, couldn't they?
They still can.
They still can. And they still should. Because instead, what we get is the craziness, and this is what everybody is thinking about, everybody's talking about as we head into the holidays, you know, everything that the Republicans are saying. They're crazy, crazy. Muslims are out to get us. We've got to shut down the borders. Donald Trump, you know, to any and all Muslims, Mexicans, Syrian refugees, everybody. That's what's going on. And I had meant to get to this a few days ago. After that Republican debate, Malala Yousafzai, the Nobel Prize winner, who was shot in the head by the Taliban because she advocated for women's education. She was, how old was, do you remember how old she was at the time that she was shot?
It was like 15 or 16 at the time. I'm not sure exactly.
Yeah, she's calling Trump's proposal to stop Muslims from coming into the U.S., she's calling it tragic, and she should know. She said, well, that's really tragic that you hear these comments, which are full of hatred, full of this ideology of being discriminative towards others. Yousafzai told the AFP news service. But more to the point, in a separate interview with UK's Channel 4, she said it's dangerous, that the comments that Trump and these others are making is dangerous. She said, I can just highlight one thing. The more you speak about Islam and against all Muslims, the more terrorists we create. So it's important that whatever politicians say, whatever the media say, they should be really, really careful about it. If your intention is to stop terrorism, do not try to blame the whole population of Muslims for it, because it cannot stop terrorism. It will radicalize more terrorists. Of course, Malala has become a worldwide icon after being shot in the head and almost killed, left for dead by the Taliban. And here she is warning us, hey, when you guys talk like that, people in my country, it makes more terrorism. Well, I guess what happened in Augusta County, Virginia, is not going to help in that regard either. This happened on Friday. Remember, coming just days after Los Angeles County shut down its entire school system, the second largest school district in the U.S., shut down its entire school system on Tuesday due to an email threat, which turned out to be a hoax, which when New York City school systems got that same email, they regarded it as a hoax immediately. But out here in Los Angeles, we are so scared, so hair trigger, about these threats, about concerns, somewhat understandably, I suppose, in that San Bernardino is right outside of Los Angeles here. But still, you know, when you fall for this stuff, when you cower in fear, when you turn on an entire religion because of it, as this nation is now clearly doing, as a lot of people, I should say, in this nation are now doing, it makes more terrorists. It is the a recruiting mechanism. Obama talked about it today. For example, he was talking about Guantanamo. He hinted at the use of his own executive authority to finally shut down Gitmo. He says he still wants to do it with Congress. He recognizes that it would be much better to do that way, even if it's an uphill battle to work with Congress, where Republicans and Democrats alike have blocked him from shutting down Gitmo, but he's looking at his executive authority to do it on his own. He says that billions are being spent right now to house 50 or 60 individuals, that it's ridiculous, and that Guantanamo continues to be, quote, one of the key magnets for jihadi recruitment. He says closing Gitmo is part of our counterterrorism strategy. Well, another part of our counterterrorism strategy should be not going crazy, not going nuts, as we saw Los Angeles County School District do this week, and as we saw on Friday now, the Augusta County School District in Virginia, which is closed. The entire school district closed on Friday for an even more ridiculous reason than the one that closed the Los Angeles schools. On Friday, parents inundated the school district with complaints about an Arabic calligraphy assignment at Riverheads High School. The December 11th assignment prompted voluminous phone calls and electronic mail locally and from outside the area, according to NBC in Washington. Augusta County Sheriff Randy Fisher told CBS that the profane and hateful messages prompted Riverheads High School to lock and monitor all of its doors on Wednesday and Thursday. And then as the complaints increased throughout the week, the law enforcement advised the school district to shut all of its schools. So here's what happened. Parents were upset over a geography assignment on world religions from a teacher out there. I don't even think I'm going to mention the teacher's name at this point because I think she has been so attacked, so ridiculously attacked. I don't want to add to it. In any event, so the teachers had students practice calligraphy by writing a Muslim statement of faith. Now, that statement was not even translated, but the Muslim statement of faith translates to "There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is the messenger of Allah." This according to the news leader in Virginia. Students were also shown a copy of the Quran. Oh, heavens, not the Quran. They saw it with their own eyes.
Their innocent, innocent eyes.
Shut down the school. Augusta County Superintendent Eric Bond said in a statement to the news leader that the Arabic message was not translated and that the teacher did not ask students to translate it or recite it or otherwise adopt it or pronounce it as a personal belief. The students were presented with a statement to demonstrate the complex artistry of the written language used in the Middle East and were asked to attempt to copy it in order to give the students an idea of artistic complexity of the calligraphy, according to the superintendent. And students are going to be completing a similar assignment when learning about China. And yet, the parents went absolutely nuts. Do they know that numerals that are we use in Arabic?
You mean 1, 2, 3,
shh,
four?
Quiet! Don't say
that. That's indoctrination.
We'll have to shut. Yes, that's...
That's right. All of the numerals that we use are Arabic numerals that were invented in the Middle East. I'm sorry. I just can't believe that we still have to talk about this.
Parents gathered on Tuesday at a forum, and this makes it sound like this town like turned into South Park, where the parents are always gathering. They're always mad. They're always upset about something. So parents actually gathered at a forum on Tuesday at the Good News Ministries in Greenville, Virginia, to express outrage over the assignment. Kimberly Herndon, the parent who organized the event, said that the assignment amounted to indoctrination. If my truth cannot be spoken in schools, I don't want false doctrines spoken in schools. That's what it keeps it even across the board. They weren't even speaking truth, this doctrine, this whatever. It was a calligraphy assignment.
It's a coloring assignment, essentially.
Essentially. She gave up the Lord's time, said Herndon, referring to the teacher's lessons. She gave it up, and she gave it to Muhammad. This is real. This is not a
wow.
South Park episode. And individuals at the forum called for the teacher to be fired. At this point,
what really surprises me about this is that when they talk about the threats coming from outside the area as mm-hmm. well as from local parents, but outside the area, they were inundated with threats.
Mm-hmm.
And that is sort of like a domestic terrorism sort of situation where you have people who have nothing to do with the classes at all threatening the schools so that they have to institute security measures.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing is that... We are so worried, or at least these people are so worried, and the Republican candidates are so worried and raising so much money and raising their polls so much on scaring people about the threat from others that we ourselves, these people themselves, are now becoming the threat. And we have a similar situation in Illinois. Wheaton College placed a tenured Christian professor. She's a Christian professor. At an evangelical college, she was put on administrative leave because she donned a hijab in solidarity, a headscarf, in solidarity with Muslim Americans facing scrutiny after recent terrorist attacks in Paris and California. This according to the Chicago Tribune. The political science professor, Larissa Hawkins, announced her intention to wear the traditional headscarf for the duration of the Christmas holidays. She declared this on Facebook last week, saying that Muslims, quote, like me, a Christian, are people of the book. We worship the same God, she said. So this professor, her explanation of why she was wearing the headscarf in solidarity with Muslims, oh, it made people angry, including the administration of this Christian college, of this private evangelical Christian college, who said she was wrongfully conflating Christianity and Islam. And so they have now put her on leave. In a statement to the Chicago Tribune, The administrators at Wheaton College said, while Islam and Christianity are both monotheistic, we believe there are fundamental differences between the two faiths, including what they teach about God's revelation to humanity, the nature of God, the path to salvation, and the life of prayer. Well, that's fine. They can have that debate. It's a school. It's a college. You're supposed to be debating ideas like that. You're not supposed to be placing teachers on leave for simply saying that Muslims, like me, a Christian, are people of the book. The college told the Chicago Tribune that Hawkins did not make her plans clear to the administration before she began wearing the hijab around campus. She didn't tell them in advance that she was going to wear this headscarf. In a statement on the school's website, officials said a full review of the, quote, theological implications of her statement would be required before her suspension was reconsidered.
If she had decided to convert to Islam, would she still have a job?
No, that's right out. That's right out. Freedom of religion? What freedom of religion? So, just remarkable. What's going on in this country? As a matter of fact, if I didn't play Star Wars there at the top, I was thinking of playing Help by the Beatles. We need somebody. If you're listening throughout the world, we have a lot of listeners throughout the world. Please send help. We need help here in this country. What has happened to our country in the past, I don't know how many weeks, is now getting scary. But I'm hoping after Christmas comes, New Year's, perhaps, maybe, we'll have peace on earth, and maybe everyone will calm down. I don't know if they will or not, but we'll see. All right, we will be back in our next thrilling episode with coverage of that secret, hidden Democratic debate over the weekend. They can hide it, but we will find it. We will find it, and we will talk about it, and we will analyze it right here on the broadcast, and I hope you will join us. Until then, if you missed any portion of today's episode or any other, you can download it at bradblog.com or over on iTunes, where we hope you will continue to give us excellent reviews. They're greatly appreciated. Those of you who have done that over at iTunes, makes it easier for the rest of the world to find the broadcast. Drop me email anytime if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. Find us and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters @TheBradBlog. Until we meet again, don't be scared. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world. Yeah.